What a week in news it's been. Kath McAloon is joining us. And Kath, the theme of change was kind of entrenched in the nation's capital this week, not least for the Nationals, who have a new leader.
That's right, Ed. Barnaby Joyce was elected unopposed to lead the National Party. In fact, he was the only one who put his hand up for the job after Warren Truss ended months of speculation about his future on Thursday by announcing that he would retire at the next election. It was a bit more of a contest for the deputy leader's role, with seven Nationals vying for that position. It ended up going to Rural Health Minister and New South Wales Senator Fiona Nash, and she becomes the first woman elected to a leadership position in the National Party. And Mr. Joyce says the Nationals will now secure a fourth position in Cabinet with the Coalition, although it's not yet clear which portfolios they'll be responsible for. And Barnaby Joyce himself has indicated that he may not necessarily remain on as the Agriculture Minister. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. However, Mr. Joyce says the Nationals will retain their commitment to the country, and he says they'll do everything possible to help Australians in rural areas.
It is about the representation of those in regional Australia and to make sure that the standard of their living is advanced, to make sure a better return goes through the farm gate, to make sure the delivery of service, the basic services, comes at an affordable rate to those people.
Of course, not only the Nationals were making headlines, but it was a big week also for retiring Trade Minister Andrew Robb, who has a very interesting connection with rural Australia.
Yeah, he's a formerly held a position with the National Farmers Federation, and I guess he's been in the news for agricultural reasons a lot in the past 12 months, signing those trade deals with Korea, Japan and China most recently. So we've heard a lot from Andrew Robb, and this won't be the last we'll hear from him. He's indicated that he'll stick around for a few more months to tie up some loose ends. He says he's still got some big things to accomplish before he retires, but it's unlikely that ratifying the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal will be one of them. There's growing community concern about this deal, which the government says will boost agriculture through lower tariffs across the Asia Pacific. It needs to be signed off by the Australian Parliament before it can take effect, and it's now likely that that job will fall to a new trade minister. Mr. Robb, in announcing his retirement plans this week, he declined to name the TPP as one of the important things that he wants to finish in the coming months.
I would like to do my best to conclude the Indian agreement. There's a deal that we're doing with Singapore. I've got responsibility for concluding that. The Indonesians, they are now extremely enthusiastic about progressing something that had stalled, but I think that might be about the limit.
Oh, never say never. You know, he actually grew up on a dairy farm, so, and then was executive director with the NFF, so he has done a lot of things in the rural world, and of course we'll all be watching the imminent shuffling of portfolios, including trade. But other news this week, some relief, according to egg producers who were cleared of some, suggested dodgy practices.
The ACCC had taken the Australian Egg Corporation to court, and they were suggesting that the corporation and some industry leaders had been involved in what they called cartel activity to limit egg supply and boost prices. But the federal court found this week that that allegation couldn't be proved. Jeff Ironside is one of several who were accused by the competition watchdog of being involved in this activity. He has a role as a director with the Egg Corporation as well as being an egg farmer himself. And he says he's relieved to be cleared of wrongdoing in this instance. But he says that the ruling gives the industry no clarity about the role that industry bodies can play in acting in good faith to avert an oversupply.
It doesn't do the industry any good at all to get dragged through the courts. What the ACCC has done is tried to use a sledgehammer to crack a nut. You know, they've spent millions of taxpayers' dollars. We weren't a cartel in the sense that nobody agreed to reduce their flock numbers or their egg numbers or anything like that on the proviso that the other fellows did at the same time. I agree, it's a pretty fine line.
And that's the difficulty there, the fine line of what is cartel activity. ACCC Chairman Rod Sims says that this legal action will send a strong message to other industry associations about getting their members together to discuss supply and prices.
That really is not what competitors should sit around the table and discuss. Having said that, the nature of this judgment might give some comfort that there are things that the burden of proof on the ACCC to establish that that has happened is so high that they could do it and we might never be able to prove the case.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm. I was chatting about this and you know, when you kind of think, well, another industry, well, maybe petrol or alcohol or you know, a whole range of other industries, a whole different perspective is added. More discussion this week about labour in rural industries and seasonal workers in particular.
Yeah, we've been following the debate about backpacker workers recently, but this week it was around the seasonal worker program, with the federal government announcing plans to expand this program. This is the program which attracts workers from Pacific Island nations and East Timor. They're allowed to come out to Australia for a certain number of months each year to do this seasonal work, and then the idea is that they take their salary and wages back home to their home country and sort of it provides some assistance there. It had been restricted to the horticulture and aquaculture industries as well as to cane growers, but it's now been expanded to sheep, cattle and grain farms, and this has been welcomed by the cattle industry. They've actually been lobbying for the last 8 years to be included in this scheme. Bim Struss is the cattle president with Agforce in Queensland, and he says that he's confident that the industry will now be able to attract seasonal workers to areas where in the past they've found it really difficult to get staff to go and work.
My knowledge of these people are that they are very, very keen to work, and they're looking forward to the opportunity of developing the skills. They haven't got the opportunities that we have in Australia. They really are keen, and you know, sometimes it doesn't matter where they go, and there's a real adventure to them in many ways.
It has to be the worst week in news ever for Tasmania's oyster industry.
Yeah, and for oyster consumers as well, with the Tassie oyster industry confirming during the week that this devastating disease outbreak will in fact see the price of oysters go up as they try and sort of deal with the impact it's had on their industry. DNA testing confirmed that the virus that's wiped out oysters in Tasmania is in fact the same strain that was found in the Hawkesbury River in New South Wales a few years ago. So there's now oyster farms in five regions of southeast Tasmania that have confirmed as testing positive to this Pacific oyster mortality syndrome. It is important to note that this virus, it's specific to Pacific oysters, and while it kills the oysters, it doesn't have human health implications. Oyster farmer James Calvert has lost nearly half of his oysters in one of his leases in the lower Pittwater area of Tassie, and he expects that he could lose as much as 100% of his juvenile oysters in Upper Pittwater. He says the future of the industry will be very different because of this disease.
You go through these waves of emotions. One minute you're up, one minute you're down. You hear some positive news, it gives you a glimmer of hope. The most gut-wrenching part of it is looking at your stock dying. Talking about it and seeing it are very two different things.
Yes, pretty devastating for James Calvert. A success story, though, or a win, if you like, for food processor SPC Admona.
And this is the latest in a series of wins for SPC
yes.
Admona. They've sort of been knocking them off as they go. There were two outstanding importers of Italian tin tomatoes that they were taking to the Anti-Dumping Commission over concerns that they were, you know, dumping product in Australia at a lower price. And during the week, the Anti-Dumping Commission and the federal government ruled that these two last exporters, who were two of the really big ones, had in fact been dumping their produce in Australia. The case was decided on appeal, and that it now means that all Italian tin tomato products that are coming into the country will now be subject to duties or tariffs when their products arrive in Australia. The Liberal MP Sharman Stone has been following this one closely because SPC Admona falls in her Victorian electorate in that Goulburn Valley region. And she says this will be an important win for the industry.
They were more than 50% of the market, the big suppliers to Coles, Woolies. So SPC appealed. In particular, they argued that the Anti-Dumping Commission had not looked at the huge subsidies that the EU pays to Italian growers and the manufacturers.
Well, the audience might do a bit of a snore fest when we talk about things like declining cattle numbers, but it's having a very real implication on regional areas in the way of jobs.
Yeah, the MLA forecast, which was put out recently, did predict that there'd be a big decline in the number of cattle slaughtered this year. And this is starting to flow on now, with Australia's second largest meat processor announcing cuts to staff numbers starting from next week. So Tees Australia will be offering redundancies to 50 staff. staff. They're scaling back to a single shift and they're reducing kill numbers by about 200 head a day at their Rockhampton plant. And there's concerns that further meat processors in other regional areas might have to follow suit, just as the cattle herd is, you know, as small as it is. Tees company spokesperson Tom Maguire says their decision is backed by that latest forecast from the MLA.
For a while, MLA forecast 16% drop in cattle available for slaughter this year, and been very large numbers of cattle consigned to export. We think there's been up to 60,000 head of cattle going out of Queensland in January. That's about three times more than there normally is.
So this shortage has sort of exacerbated a bit of argy-bargy between local meat processors and people that are exporting cattle overseas. Alison Penfold of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council says that it shouldn't be a sort of a them versus us situation in the meat industry, and she's saying that exporters are also struggling with this dwindling herd.
We are all challenged as a red meat sector with supply challenges because of the drought, so it's difficult for everybody at the moment. But I think everybody agrees that choice in the system does help support a strong supply chain.
And now Wool for Dummies. Kath, what is a carding?
Well, wool cardings are the shorter fibres of the wool fleece, and traditionally the wool cardings, they're not valued as highly as the lovely sort of merino fleeces are.
They're the kind of bits that are chopped off.
Yeah, the little scraps. Little scraps. That's a good way of putting it. But there's a real demand for them at the moment, and this is thought to be because of changing tastes in European fashion, which is peculiar to think, but that's thought to be driving what's been a massive price increase for cardings, which are normally sold much cheaper than the main fleece of the wool. Stephen Reed is from Michelle Wool, and he says that cardings are used in blends to make garments like heavy coats, and those coats are becoming much more fashionable in the Northern Hemisphere. And he says the price for carding wool has almost doubled in value because of this.
We've seen the fleece wools holding a very attractive pricing. So these cardings come up incredibly close to them. So we're looking at record pricing for cardings, or what some people call oddments. We've seen locks trading between $11.50 and $12 a kilo, which is just extraordinary by any measure.
Whenever I think of Kakadu National Park, I kind of imagine this sort of rainforesty environment of tumbling waterfalls and green oasis.
Not this year.
Not so much. No.
We often, I guess when we talk about a dry, wet season, we often think about the impact it has on agriculture, but it also has a big impact on the natural environment. And the World Heritage listed Kakadu National Park is now suffering through one of its driest wet seasons ever. So between October and the end of January, Jabiru, which is the main township in the park, it recorded only 340 millimetres of rain, and that is less than half what it would normally get in that period. And it's having big implications for local tourism operators in that region. Liam Ma is from Kakadu Cultural Tours, and he says it's been too dry to put boats in the water to run the wetland cruises that his Indigenous guides rely on.
The floodplains are still filling up, and we have had just a little bit of a wet period that pushed the water up, but we're not that optimistic it's going to stay up. So we don't know if we're operating a product yet for the wet season. We hope so.
And talk about meeting demand, like right from the ground.
This is a really interesting story. You think potatoes are sort of round-shaped?
Yes.
And that means cutting the perfectly shaped potato chip might soon become a whole lot easier, because growers in Tasmania have started trialling a new variety of potato that grows in sort of like a brick shape, like a rectangular shape.
Yep.
Who'd have thought? Frank Mulcahy is from Simplot, one of the big food processors that makes, frozen chips. And he says that these square-sided spuds are just what the industry needs.
It has the right shape for us. To produce French fries, you want a potato that is blocky. It needs to be brick-shaped, because French fries have square edges. So when that goes through the knives, there's maximum recovery. Very much a square peg in a square hole. And square pegs are hard to find in this industry.
Just extraordinary. It almost sounded like he was giving a sort of wine tasting example for a moment there for potatoes.
There you go.
Thank you, Kath.
Thanks, Edwina.
Can we see a picture of that potato?
Yeah, we hope to have one up on the ABC Rural website. So head online.
Excellent.
And have a look.
Excellent. You can also find there some great profile writing and analysis of all those key players in the Nationals. That's at abc.net.au/rural.